You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I'm delighted to say that my guest in the studio today is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. My guest is Danny Dorling. Hello.
Hi there.
You have a new book out, sir. It has a brick on the cover. It made me think, reading All That Is Solid, The Great Housing Disaster, that anyone who is reading this alertly might want to think about having bricks in their hands. Is that fair?
Yes, it did get a bit longer than it was supposed to be. So it is quite a thick book, yeah.
But also the idea that there's a lot in this book. There's a lot in this book that made me angry and a lot that I found really upsetting. Does that mean I've become British at last, that I'm upset about housing?
Yes, you're beginning to become more British, but it helps that you're in London. I began writing that book in Sheffield, and it wasn't that angry a book. And moving to Oxford and then trying to find housing in Oxford helped make it a bit more angry. So if you weren't based in London, you may not have become such a Brit quite so quickly.
The Great When does feature a lot in this, and there's a line in here that I thought was particularly telling and particularly merciless, which is, you describe London as the former capital of an old imperial empire that now functions more like an offshore tax haven.
Yes.
It's pretty damning and sleazy sounding.
It's fairly damning, but there are international definitions of what a tax haven is. And when you look at them, the UK, and in particular London, would actually qualify along with the Cayman Islands and various other places. So we have got ourselves into a position that is particularly embarrassing, and we need to be embarrassed about it. And we're quite good at being embarrassed in Britain, as long as we learn what it is we need to be embarrassed about. And becoming a tax haven really isn't something to be particularly proud of.
And so there's the illusion of growth and the illusion of the property market booming.
Yeah.
And also, you point out perhaps that there's a conspiracy of silence. You discuss Ireland and the housing crash there and the economic crash and the fact that Irish people said, well, we didn't really know anything about that. We didn't read anything about it in the papers. Yeah. Is there the sense that we don't want to know too much about what happened in Spain or Portugal or Ireland because it might frighten us?
And in Ireland before the crash, there was very little warning of what was possible. Very little material from the doubters was published. And people have analysed this in Ireland as things, because, of course, in Ireland now that house prices have halved, or more than halved in some cases, you have a very angry population. And they've gone back and looked at their kind of how lethargic the media was beforehand. But the amazing thing in Britain is how little reporting we get about Ireland. It's not exactly far away. How little reporting we get about the USA and what's happened to the housing market there. And it's partly linked to the stake that people in Britain, particularly people in London, particularly people over 40, have in housing. In that they really do need this market to, as far as they think, they need this market to carry on to survive. And if it keeps on bubbling upwards, they feel they're getting richer. And so they don't want to knock it. But young Londoners are the opposite. They're getting irate. People in their 30s and under in London are beginning to work out, not only they've been handed a very large student debt, which is growing, but now they're being put into a situation where they're having to pay higher and higher rent. It's going up by 10% a year. And when they start to form families and want to buy their starter homes, they can't buy them because some landlord's gone and bought the starter homes. And so you're getting this split in London between an older group who appear to be doing well and the younger group who are getting very, very angry about the situation.
Do you think the worm has turned? I mean, I wondered how you thought this book would be received, because obviously as a scholar who touches on a lot of issues of inequality, you know that the usual suspects will find it easier to say, well, he's got a political agenda, yeah, or it is the sort of thing an academic would say, especially someone we think might be vaguely left-wing.
Yeah.
But you are taking on a lot of powerful people in this book. So did you think you'd be covered with as much mud as people could manage, or
Some mud. I think the worm is turning in some ways, but there's also some great ignorance in some ways. So earlier today I was discussing with somebody who represents Landlords Association, who is trying to say that because they're only making 6% profit a year, they were doing very badly. And it just showed how they just didn't have a grasp about how the average person in Britain has become poorer. the fact that they're complaining that they're not making a 15 or 20% profit a year, but only a 6% profit. So I think there's more still a sense of just enormous ignorance going on. But the second thing to say is that this housing crisis and the cost of living crisis has now stretched into a large proportion of the top 10% of people in Britain are affected. Now, you can normally get away with having wide and high inequality as long as the top 10 and 20% are being looked after. But once you get into a situation where the majority of the top 10% are seeing their take-home pay fall and their housing costs rise, it's really hard to fool the top 10% as well as the rest of the population. And in that sense, I think the worm is turning in that such a tiny proportion of people are now doing well that most people are beginning to not blame themselves for the fact that they're not well off. And they're beginning to realise that you can't all fit into the 1%.
And this top 10 who are starting to feel the squeeze, they are the people tactfully referred to as the squeezed middle,
yes.
Are they not?
They are referred to as the squeezed middle.
From the perspective of people who are well-to-do, they see them as...
Yes. Well, I mean, the amazing thing you hear from people who are well-to-do is they see mortgages as something that poor people take out, which is quite a shock to suddenly realise that that's their way of thinking.
You talk a lot in the book about cash buyers for things. Of course, that always does sound to me like brown envelopes full of ill-gotten gains, but it's not merely that, is it?
It's just for people with enough wealth that you wouldn't take out a loan to buy something. And just as most middle class, or by middle I actually mean medium in the middle of the distribution, people wouldn't buy goods on loans. You'd save up and, you know, buy yourself a radio or a bike or something
the
else.
The higher purchase method.
Yep. For the rich, they don't buy housing with debt, and a lot of landlords are now buying houses using the cash that they're getting from the rents that they're charging. So there's a group of landlords who are getting out of having to borrow money to increase their housing empires.
The old rentier society writ large. Mm. I thought it quite interesting. You mentioned at one point in the book about a colleague who jokes about, quite bitterly or unsettlingly, about putting up an electric fence around their home to let the nanny in and keep the rabble out. That kind of apocalyptic thinking obviously shows that, as you say, higher up the income distribution, people are thinking about and worrying about how bad things can get.
Well, some people are. I mean, this is a particularly, you know, somebody from the more enlightened part of the 1%, but certainly from the 1%. Not thinking that things are going to change much and not thinking there's going to be a redistribution. But realising that for the rest of society, by which this particular colleague meant the 99%, things are going to get worse for all of them. And then the question was, well, how are you going to carry on? And in a sense, putting up barriers, it wouldn't be an electric fence, but you would make sure that you didn't house the poor near their house. And there are people, I think, thinking of a model of how could Britain become even more unequal, rather than, and thinking that anything else isn't feasible. And that's fairly sad, so I thought I'd report it.
Yeah. I think there must be, even for people who are not quite so high up the ladder, the sense of anxiety about housing, again talking about homeowners over 40, as you say, in the southeast of England. Yeah. Guilt, worry that so much money is being spent for so little.
Yeah.
Anxiety about the fact that we know things are different in other places.
Yeah. Well, over 40 now, between 40 and 50 now means first time buyer. So these are people who've just bought,
just scrambled into a terrible
flat. At the
top
of the market, and don't sleep at night because they're worried about a 0.5% interest rate rise, which they couldn't cope. And these are some of the best paid people in the country. And they're relying on it going up a little bit more, so that another cohort, 2 or 3 years on, will be those most at risk. And the fact that this kind of fear and anxiety and worry is gripping people who are some of the best rewarded in the UK, I mean, that really is new. And housing is almost the only way in which people very near the top of the income structure are experiencing some of the kind of suffering that other people experience from problems with schools or problems with employment or problems just buying food. These are not worries for people in the top tenth, but housing is a worry for people in the top tenth. And it's one of the few ways in which the rich can empathise with the problems of the majority of society.
I was surprised that the review of this book in the Evening Standard, when you told me by email yesterday that the Standard was reviewing the book, I wondered whether of course, I see it as a paper for commuters, but also for London and the city, and it needs to boost things. It seemed like a positive review. It does strike me then that maybe more people are open to this message than I thought.
There is a worm turning. The Standard has actually been running a poverty campaign in London. Standard is a fairly extreme newspaper, but it's quite incredible some things going on in the Standard. But also the particular reporter, you could get a sense of their life coming out in that review, which shows how this works. But as well as the Standard, the Financial Times now has begun to look at the state of things in Britain and see it as unsustainable. And that's the FT. I mean, if 10 years ago I'd sort of said the FT would be saying we had a major problem with greed and wealth at the top, you know, it would be hard to have imagined. But so we are seeing a shift. The shift is happening gradually. So we acclimatise it so we don't celebrate part of it and we still have huge problems. But we are seeing a movement in attitudes and opinions. And in some ways, it's similar to the kind of shift that happened in the late 20s and much of the 1930s in Britain, when those at the top of society went from being incredibly arrogant and not caring about people in the bottom to becoming much better informed and much less greedy. So salaries at the top in the 30s stopped rising, partly because people began to realise in an era of mass unemployment, asking for more and behaving like they behaved in the early 20s really had stopped becoming acceptable.
And was no longer in their own interest, perhaps?
Wasn't in their own interest, no. But the big difference, of course, then is that there'd just been a revolution in Russia. So they had something to really concentrate their minds about what happens if you do treat the poor badly.
It focused their minds. Yeah. Here's something that our reviewer, that you haven't seen the review yet, has said in his review. Back in the early 1990s, when he first began to publish, this is speaking of you, there was a feeling in geography that Danny Dorling was somewhat out of step with the approaches fashionable at the time. Back then, too many of us spent too long crafting ever more elaborate but ultimately disengaged cultural theory, little of which endured. Geography's failure to contribute to the big debates in ways that it could and should is a continuing concern. Dorling's belief in evidence, engagement, and impact is helping to address that public lacuna. Now, of course, that's a very nice thing of him to say, but does that jive with what your experience was when in 1992 you wrote in The Observer, houses are for living in, not for profit, with some colleagues, essentially, you know, one of the things that you're saying now. Do you feel like you were a very young academic at the time, you just got your doctorate, but do you feel like geography is moving around to your approach?
Parts of it slowly. Are also back then, and I still find writing quite difficult. And back then, I found it incredibly difficult. I was good at maths; I could draw computer maps, but I couldn't have been a cultural geographer because my ability to spell very long words just isn't good enough. The other thing, to be fair to what cultural geographers were writing then, is that they were almost writing in code about what was wrong in society. And I think they were partly writing in code because they were scared of being labelled as radicals. So they, you know, if you decode, and now I've got old enough I can actually read and that I can skim read an art paper that an undergraduate can never understand, and I could see what the three line summary of the entire paper is. And it's basically saying everything is wrong and it's all terrible and we need a new world. But if you look back at that time, coming out of the Cold War and so on, being on the left was seen as being odd. Marxism was on the way down from the 1970s.
The end of history, apparently.
Oh, yes, and the rise of all of that on the right. And the left in academia, in a way, retreated into more obscure language.
So they couldn't be caught?
They were somehow scared of being caught, and also they might have been scared because the students were becoming more right-wing. So maybe they didn't want the undergraduates to actually understand, you know, or at least the undergraduates had to put some effort in before they could understand what their teachers were actually thinking. I'm being a bit unfair, but I'm trying to be charitable to it. And it's more complicated than that. I mean, they were also making intellectual jumps and leaps at the time, and moving between disciplines in a way that we hadn't before. Because if you look at geography, one of the interesting things about geography, this is a discipline which was largely created in England to train young men to run an empire. To draw a map, understand the mountains and rivers, know how crops form, all those kind of things. Once the colonies gained independence in the 1960s, the actual rationale need to produce geographers decreased, and its sister discipline is anthropology, and it shrunk dramatically. Geography was searching around for a new home or a new reason to exist, and part of what was going on at the time was trying to think of new aspects for geographers to be interested in. The nice thing that's happened now to geography is that, almost partly by accident, it stumbled across two of the main issues of the day. One is climate change, which is what almost a majority of physical geographers are now involved in looking at, and suddenly they've become incredibly relevant. And the other is poverty and inequality, which is largely a geographical issue because it's most clearly seen when you look at differences between countries and differences within countries and differences within cities. So geography has found a new purpose or reason to exist. But back then, from the 80s to the 90s, it was kind of stumbling around. And it could have largely disappeared as a discipline. In much of the world, it has disappeared.
You mention in this book that the genesis of the book is one. It was suggested by Tom Penn at Penguin, your editor, and you also mentioned that Anthony Harwood, your agent, helped quite a lot. We know that you've written about these issues before, but I thought it was an incredibly generous thing of an academic, or indeed any author, to say, not I thought up this idea myself, these are my ideas. Of course, nobody shapes anything. They come straight from my giant forehead onto the page. That's a very generous and humble way to describe how this book came
about.
It's
not so much that. It's partly being honest and partly trying to explain that I honestly didn't have an axe to grind at the beginning of this. They suggested it, and I wasn't still at all sure, because you always have your own ideas you want to do. But I tend to find that when people suggest you do something, they've often got a point. And also, I had a kind of guilt about housing because it was the beginning of my career. My first research jobs were in housing. The Roundtree Foundation funded my first fellowship. I was funded to look at homelessness, and then that was overtaken by a small housing crash and negative equity. So I'd done lots of my first academic papers, which, of course, they're the ones that are really hard to do, that take you 3 or 4 months to write, and then they're turned down. All that first part of my career had been looking at housing. And I'd only written things which were largely obscure on it. And I also thought, we're coming around again to another kind of crisis. I've been here before, so you can write with a little bit more reflection on it. But without their encouragement, and also without them, I mean, they did take the first draft, move it around entirely, cut a large chapter. And so part of the reason why the book is a brick is because when somebody moves it all around and says they want you to write more parts, you end up adding more than you take away. But hopefully that helps.
It's also obviously a very topical book. No one can write a book that's not of its time. But you say quite clearly at many points, you know, as I'm writing this at the end of 2013, do you worry that it will be overtaken by events, or maybe good events, but possibly awful events?
I mean, somebody's claimed that there's been a book written about housing every year for the last 40 years, I think. I mean, as I was finishing the first draft of this, house prices were actually falling in parts of London. And then, I mean, this was only summer 2013. Government policy from the budget of 2013 onwards began to concentrate more on housing than anything else. So housing always changes, and it's a kind of very random fluctuation to do with prices. But I happen to be drafting and redrafting and editing this book at a time of more change in housing than before. And I think that was good because it got me more interested in it, because clearly this was an unstable situation. Why are you getting new government policy after new government policy? Why is the Prime Minister bringing Help to Buy, which was supposed to start in January of this year? He suddenly brought it forward to the week before his election speech. And it was partly because they were scared that the houses' prices were going to fall.
And then the sky really will fall for a lot of people, won't it?
If they fall for a lot of people's... A very large number of people in England are basing their hopes and are trying to lay their fears on the idea that their property will look after them.
It's my pension.
Yeah.
How many times have you heard that?
Yeah, it's my pension, or it's my children's futures. It's their deposits. And people often see the sort of sum of their life's work as being wrapped up in the positive equity that is in their house. So politically, this government, this coalition, really can't cope with a price fall, even though it would be so desirable for so many people. And in a sense, if all prices fall a bit gently, you know, it really doesn't hurt those at the top that much, and those are the top of those who've got most.